Her work. He called her novels mere dishwashings. I can believe this. Thomas Carlyle. Poor Jane, his wife. I have some. You ever heard of Jane Carlyle's diaries? Thomas Carlyle's wife. She was, I think, a thwarted writer in some ways, except these diaries are pretty incredible. I have some excerpts I'll bring in. Okay, well, I guess that's the Victorian era. Dishwashings. Okay. Charlotte Bronte didn't particularly like her work. She didn't like her representing men and women as ladies and gentlemen. This offended her sensibility and her sense of real passion. There's a quote of hers. I think she's speaking about Pride and Prejudice. An accurate daguerreotyped portrait of a commonplace face, a carefully fenced, highly cultivated garden with neat borders and delicate flowers. In a way, I've been finding that just in comments in passing with some of you that it's either pro or con. Maybe it comes down to comedy and tragedy or head over heart. I think it's a real head book, personally. And I don't know, kind of like watching an opera or something, comic opera. And I feel a little distant from the characters in a way, but see them as representing or embodying the big things, you know, the big things that make people move. Actually, Pride and Prejudice? One of her books has been compared to The Marriage of Figaro. I guess it's Pride and Prejudice. Just sort of interesting. There's this Walpole's dictum. This world is a comedy to those that think, a tragedy to those that feel. Then other comments about her. What? Horace Walpole?
Yeah, Shakespeare's.
Shakespeare said that?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
That's where I read it.
Huh. It's been attributed to Walpole.
It doesn't sound like Shakespeare.
No, it doesn't. Oh, it wouldn't be in one of his plays, I'm sure.
It's a poem, a sonnet or something. I think that's where I read it.
Well, check it out. Mark Twain disliked her work intensely. But of course, he's an American speaking for sort of this liberated consciousness or something. And he has a quote, "She inspires an animal repugnance." He calls her characters Presbyterians. And actually, if anything, he comes out of the same sort of, I mean, he's reacting towards against the same thing that Emily Dickinson is coming out of, which is this, you know, Puritan heritage and Calvinist tradition or whatever. So he equates her with that. And, you know, he feels like the characters never get physical, never get sensual, and has no taste for it at all. He says also about, whenever I take up, at least he read the books, whenever I take up Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility, I feel like a barkeeper entering the kingdom of heaven. And he refers to her characters as manufacturers, which are unable to warm up and feel a passion. I think that's the same problem Bronte has too, this lack of, you know, I mean, these characters just never even kiss, I don't think. James likes her, but he also has a few derogatory statements. And in a way, he's reacting against what people make of her, just the way you were reacting to the whole Dickinson myth, you know, that she's everybody's Jane, you know, sweet little Jane, and so on. He just gets sick of that comments. But he also calls her one of the finest painters of life. And Henry James. Then another quote of his, "With all her light felicity," something blah, 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 "with all her light felicity, leaves us hardly more curious of her process or the experience in her that fed it than the brown thrush who tells the story from the garden bough." Well, that can be interpreted another way. I mean, one might be interested in the brown thrush who tells the story from the garden bough. Wolf likes her, Virginia Woolf, and in fact, there's one essay, I don't remember who wrote it, talking about Woolf and Austin, you know, connection there. And E.M. Forster was a big defender of hers. He says somebody asks him a question, what did you learn from her technically? And he says, I learned the possibilities of domestic humor. And then I guess in this country in the 30s and 40s, this business of making her Freudian or Marxist. I mean, it's just endless what critics or interpreters will do. I think the best thing, I mean, it's interesting to see the context, you know, that she is coming out of, but it's best to just read the work and make up your own mind. Here's a little background. I mean, there's no sense of what's going on when she's writing. There's this incredible war going on, Battle of Waterloo and things like that. Just no mention. Slave trade. There is, Sir Thomas Bertram goes to the West Indies. How many of you have gotten that far? Antigua. You assume there's some slave labor going on there. I'm not sure how to. Okay, she was born in 1775 at the parsonage house of Steventon, where she lived, I'm not sure until that date. Anyway, her father was a country vicar who also took in outside students, private students. And he had married the daughter of another well-educated clergyman. Her parents were both well-educated and read a lot. They had some social status. They were able to keep a carriage and horses. That's any indication of status, neither rich nor poor. She had five brothers. Two of them became admirals in the British Navy. And there's some Navy men in her novels, as you see. I think one of them was in Portsmouth, which is in Mansfield Park. She died at the age of 41. She was very close to her sister, Cassandra. And in fact, when the sister went to school, they had to send Jane along, afraid of what the separation would do. She was something like 7 years old. She went away. But one book says that most of her education was at home. She knew French and some Italian, played the piano and sang. And as one of her first stories, Love and Friendship, Friendship spelled FREINDSHIP, was written at the age of 15 to amuse her schoolmates. And she used to write plays, and there was a barn next to the parsonage which served as a little theater. So that element also comes into Mansfield Park, these theatricals. In 1802, they moved to Bath, which had been a very, very posh spa, and then kind of went and saw lesser days, and people of her class started to settle there, clergymen and so on. I think during that period, she didn't get back to her writing until she got back into a country setting. Bath was in effect a little city, town life. The father died a couple of years later, 1805, and they finally went back to the country life in, I think, 1807 or so. After the father died, someone made a gift to her mother of a house back near, wasn't far from Steventon, same kind of setting. And there she revised two of the earlier novels and wrote four more. And this was all within a period of 10 years. And then in 1816 she got ill and went in under a doctor's care the following year and then died. I can't remember. I think one source said that, what, indefinite. It was unusual because the family had a history of longevity. She died quite young, comparatively. Her books, none of her books appeared in print until she was 35 years old. The first one was in 1811. And yet these first three, as I mentioned, had been written earlier and later revised. And the first three were written before she was 23. Incredible. Pride and Prejudice was originally called First Impressions. And Sense and Sensibility was Eleanor and Marianne. And Susan became Northanger Abbey. And at Chawton, where the mother settled later, she would work in the family sitting room and then hide her papers under the blotting paper. People would come into the room. And Virginia Woolf has some, oh God, we have to stop. Some comment here. Jane Austen, let's see. Still, it would be easier to write prose and fiction than to write poetry or a play. Less concentration is required. Jane Austen wrote like that to the end of her days. Quote, how she was able to effect all this, her nephew writes in his memoir, is surprising, for she had no separate study to repair to, and most of the work must have been done in the general sitting room, subject to all kinds of casual interruptions. She was careful that her occupation should not be suspected by servants or visitors or any persons beyond her own family party. Jane Austen hid her manuscripts or covered them with a piece of blotting paper. Then again, all the literary training that a woman had in the early 19th century was training in the observation of character, in the analysis of emotion. Her sensibility had been educated for centuries by the influences of the common sitting room. People's feelings were impressed on her. Personal relations were always before her eyes. Therefore, when the middle-class woman took to writing, she naturally wrote novels, even though, as seems evident enough, two of the four famous women have here named were not by nature novelists. This goes on, but she talks about the style. And I wondered, would Pride and Prejudice have been a better novel if Jane Austen had not thought it necessary to hide her manuscript from visitors? I read a page or two to see, but I could not find any signs that her circumstances had harmed her work in the slightest. That perhaps was the chief miracle about it. Here was a woman, about the year 1800, writing without hate, without bitterness, without fear, without protest, without preaching. That was how Shakespeare wrote, I thought, looking at Antony and Cleopatra. And when people compare Shakespeare and Jane Austen, they may mean that the minds of both had consumed all impediments. And for that reason, we do not know Jane Austen, and we do not know Shakespeare. And for that reason, Jane Austen pervades every word that she wrote, and so does Shakespeare. Okay, we'll stop there.
Did everybody know?